Hi, I'm Christy Lee, the creator of Canadian True Crime. Join me for an immersive deep dive into some of the most thought-provoking true crime cases in Canada. Using facts curated from court documents, inquiry reports, and news archives, I carefully unravel and analyze each case, exposing the pitfalls of the criminal justice system that everyone needs to know about. Find Canadian True Crime wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CanadianTrueCrime.ca.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
This season of Violent Crime contains material that might be tough to hear. Sweethearts explores themes of human trafficking, sexually exploited youth, violence, and murder. So please, take care while listening.
Check, check, check. Okay, we're recording.
It's a cold, windy night in downtown Victoria. It's just after Christmas, and the Christmas lights are still up. They're flickering blue and white, and pretty white ribbons hang in the trees. I'm standing at Trounce Alley. This is what used to be known as the Victoria Stroll. It's the place where Kimberly Gallup, Sherry Smith, and Melissa Nicholson once used to work. Three teenagers, all last seen right here in downtown Victoria before they're killed. Tonight, I'm kitty-corner to an Irish pub I'm fond of visiting when I'm in town. And there are still signs of the kind of street life that Kimberly and Sherry and Melissa came to know well. Right now, it's just coming up to 10 o'clock. I'm getting ready to go home to my comfortable hotel for the night. But this would have been right around the time when the three teens would have just been starting their shift on the stroll. I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Island Crime, Season 6, Sweethearts.
Another climb, another fall, another try, another call. You made your choice to be alone. You had the chance to change it all. Another moon, another sun. You drop your petals one by one. You shut the roses with your gun. You didn't stay, you chose to run. I'm not mad, I'm just sorry. I couldn't make you feel safe. I will give you space, don't you worry. I will learn how to dance in the rain.
Standing in the place that was once the Victoria Stroll has a strong effect on me. Whenever possible, I try to go to the scene of the crime. And the Victoria Stroll is the place where Kimberly, Sherry, and Melissa were being trafficked on the nights they were murdered. Standing in the dark in this place draws me closer to their stories. The more I learn about these girls, the more I'm being pulled in. Three teenagers robbed of their lives, murdered here on the island more than three decades ago. Their cases still unsolved. And it's easy to see why their cases hit home. I see myself and the girls I went to school with reflected in their high school pictures. And it's not just the hairstyles, the makeup, and the fashions. This episode is focused on Sherry Lynn Smith. Sherry is raised as a Christian. She attends Catholic schools. I do too. Around the same time Sherry is performing in a Christian puppet show, I'm playing the guitar in my Christian youth group. I'm wearing a uniform to school, and I'm still going to church with my parents on Sundays. But I'm also starting to drink, to smoke a little pot, and I'm hanging around with some questionable characters. It's very easy to see how my life could have taken a different path. I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Island Crime, Season 6, Sweethearts. This is episode 2, After the Fair. September is a beautiful time of year on the island. Summer typically stretches into the school year. On September 9th, 1990, a young woman named Tracy Madsen is out for a ride on her horse, Tarzan. Her mom, Trudy, owns the Oak Meadows Stables in Saanich, just outside of Victoria. Thinking back, Tracy recalls it was likely mid-afternoon. She's not a morning person, so she would normally take her horse out sometime after lunch. The scent of death is in the air that day.
Yes, I am the one that found her.
Tracy has happened upon a dead body.
I was out on a trail ride with my horse, and I was by myself, and I was walking by, and I'm like, what the heck is that smell? Anyways, then I kind of poked down a little bit, and then it was like, then I went back to the barn and put the horse away and looked, and I was like, oh my gosh.
2 months before Kimberly Gallup is murdered, Sherry's body is found about a 15-minute drive away in a rural area. Sherry was last seen on the Victoria Stroll, virtually the same place Kimberly meets a client the night she's killed. The place Tracy has made her discovery is not far from the family property. She takes her horse back to the barn and returns to take a closer look, unsure of what she's come upon.
She was covered in a blanket, and I didn't get to really see.
This is horse country, close to Francis King Regional Park, a forested area. It would not be uncommon to come across dead wildlife, perhaps a deer.
I didn't go down and pull the blankets over or anything, but I knew it was a person.
How did you know it was a person?
I think I saw hair or something, or I, you know, I, geez, I turned back the memory bank.
You said there was a blanket over her?
Yeah.
So it looked like she had been covered up somehow?
Absolutely.
Was the blanket like a, was it a horse blanket or was it a?
No. I can't remember. I'm not sure if it was pink or blue. It was like a bedding blanket type idea.
I want Tracy to try to remember exactly where the body is found. The scene itself could be significant.
The Fork and Munson Prospect?
Yep.
So when you go up Munns Road up to Francis Park, before you get to Francis Park, like it's still going up the hill, not too far.
Tracy tells me it's her thought at the time that whomever was responsible had rolled the body down the hill.
So about how far in from the road?
Well, the road, you could probably walk on the side of the road and then it just kind of veered down a little incline.
Yeah.
So I couldn't see it by walking by. So I had to get off my horse and kind of look down the ravine a little bit. And then it was noticeably there. So
the body is not at all well hidden, but the area is rural. Mostly people drive by and it wouldn't have been visible from a car.
If you have any more questions, please don't hesitate. Give me a call. Well, best of wishes, girl.
Okay, thanks so much.
A note. The newspaper accounts of Sherry's death all say a man on horseback found Sherry. I've asked the police if they can clear up this discrepancy. So far, they have not responded. But I've spoken with two retired Saanich police officers. Neither of them can recall any other body being found in this area around that time. Sherry Smith has been missing since June 4, 1990, just a few weeks after her 18th birthday. The police reports from the time describe her body as having been dumped in the underbrush in the Saanich rural area. The picture of Sherry that accompanied the stories is a real heartbreaker. Sherry has long, curly, dark hair, a heart-shaped face, full, rosy cheeks, and a wide smile. Her eyes are dark and sparkling. She's wearing a cranberry-colored sweater, and she is so pretty. She looks like a Disney princess, Snow White. And there's another detail that makes Sherry's murder even more tragic. Sherry is 6 months pregnant when she's killed, and she is far from home. Sherry is from Regina. Regina is a smaller Canadian city on a flat plain in the south-central part of the country. It's named for Queen Victoria, but was once known as Wascana, taken from the Cree word for buffalo bones. It was named for the heaps of bones left there after skinning and cutting buffalo. Terry Lynn Smith attends Catholic high school in Regina with Sherry. She vividly recalls the moment she learns her high school classmate has been killed.
I was home for lunch and I heard it on the news, but because her name sounds so similar, it sounded like they said Terry Lynn Smith of Regina. And I was like, wait. I actually got a few phone calls from people who thought they had heard Terry Lynn Smith. My mom was one of those people. So I drove back to the school. And when I got back to the high school, people were crying and they were talking about it at school. And that's when I found out that it was Sherry.
To be clear, Terry and Sherry are not related. They share a common last name. But the fact that the two girls also share a middle name and a similar sounding first name is just chance. I also attend Catholic school at around the same time. So I have an idea of what that experience might have been like.
Dresses had to be a certain length and dances we weren't really supposed to touch while we were dancing, that kind of thing. I was studying the Bible, and of course, you know, that included sex ed, which was don't do it.
Terry recalls Sherry sitting in front of her in class. They aren't close, but they chat from time to time at school.
I just remember her sitting in front of me in class. She was pretty social, smiley, very outgoing, and I was very shy, so we didn't really have the same friends.
Then Terry observes something changing in her schoolmates' world.
It was kind of like a gradual thing where she started skipping school and, you know, ducking out, and then she just kind of faded. I heard kind of whisperings that she was missing maybe at one point, but it wasn't until we found out, or for me, it wasn't until we found out that they had found her body that I really realized what had been going on.
You have to remember, this is 1990. It's pre-social media. The internet itself is in its infancy. So news that their high school friend, a teenager who has been attending this small Catholic high school, has been found murdered, absolutely shakes the school community.
It was shocking. It was something, like, it just doesn't happen.
When a young woman is murdered, it is not unusual for a boyfriend to emerge as a possible person of interest. I asked Terry if she ever met Sherry's boyfriend.
I think I might have, because I bumped into her. I don't think I ever met him. I just saw him in passing. I think because I was there the day that she met him, because we were all at Buffalo Days or whatever.
Tell me about that, Buffalo Days. I have never been to Buffalo Days. What is Buffalo Days?
Okay, so Buffalo Days is just like the town exhibition with the rides and the games, and it's in Regina every year. And that's basically, I think, where she met him. That's where we met guys. We went there, a group of friends. We went on the rides, and we were all there. Like, that's what you did. It was probably the only thing to do in the summer.
I remember going to the fair when it rolled into our town. The city I grew up in was roughly the same size as Sherry's hometown. It was a big deal to go to the Midway. New sounds, new smells, new people. As Terry says, it was the thing to do for girls their age. But the young man Sherry has met, the guy she falls for at the fair, is actually a sex trafficker, or what we would have called a pimp back then. And Sherry's life has just taken a deadly turn. It's been more than 30 years since that life-altering day at the fair. Terry has never forgotten her high school classmate. Then one day, not long ago, Terry gets a phone call.
A detective contacted me about a year or two ago asking me if I knew. They threw out a name and asked me if I knew a person of interest, and I didn't know anything. It was a female person of interest from the Victoria area.
A female person of interest. Now, that is not something I've ever read anything about in past reporting. And I'm not sure how much stock to put into this. But I make a note to see if I can take this information any further. Sherry's death still haunts Terry.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart. She made, you know, she fell in love with a boy and she made some mistakes. And she was, well, lured into a lifestyle. But she was a 16-year-old girl. She was someone's daughter. You know, like I didn't have the greatest childhood, and I made some pretty big mistakes in my life, and it very, very, very easily could have been me. It was just the luck of the draw that it was her and not me. It breaks my heart. I can't imagine what it's been like for her family, not knowing.
33 years on, Terry is still hoping there will be answers for Sherry's family. In a moment, you're going to hear the voices of Sherry's parents. But first, I want to tell you something about them and the devastation Sherry's murder has had on their lives. I first begin trying to reach the couple almost 2 years ago, when Sherry's case first crosses my desk. I send out multiple email queries, and I make some phone calls, but I hear nothing back. At this point, I'm not sure if any of my messages have reached them. And then one day, I get a phone call from Sherry's mom. She tells me she and her husband have been praying on whether they should speak with me. We arrange a time for an interview. And then I get a call. Sherry's mom says talking about Sherry means they'll be consumed once again by a tide of grief. They can't do it. In the years after Sherry's murder, her parents devote themselves to bringing meaning to Sherry's life. They give hundreds of talks about sex trafficking. They speak at John schools. These are educational programs aimed at the men who are clients of sex workers. They open themselves up to countless questions and painful interviews. But now, at this stage of their lives, it's just too hard. The Smiths have already shared so much about their lovely daughter. Here's what I'm able to learn about Sherry. Sherry plays piano. She plays the flute too. She is a bright B+ student at the Catholic high school she attends. Sherry hits a rebellious phase as a young teen. But it's that chance encounter at the fair that pulls Sherry into a world of sexual exploitation. That boy she meets at the fair, the young guy she falls hard for, is a sex trafficker. In the period leading up to her death, she's being trafficked in cities around Western Canada. Sherry is described by other sex workers in Victoria as timid and desperate to make friends. A friend of Sherry's, also a teenager being sex trafficked named Melody, says Sherry would spend her days reading the Bible and writing to her parents. And it is Melody who first reports Sherry as missing after last seeing her in the early hours of June 4th. Melody is only ever mentioned in news articles by her first name, and I have been unable to track her down. Melody, if you're listening now, please do get in touch. The Smiths also give me permission to use the audio from an interview they gave to a Christian TV show called Listen Up. Here's Sherry's dad describing his daughter as a child.
As a little girl, Sherry was just the most adorable child you could hope for. We'd been married 3 years when Sherry was born, and she was a very compliant, loving child, and we couldn't have been happier to have such a loving little girl in our home.
The Smiths are a strong Christian family. Sherry attends church regularly. At one point, she's a member of a traveling puppet group called the God Squad. She's a solid student, but in grade 9, something changes. Sherry begins acting out. Here's Sherry's mom.
Yes, in about grade 9, halfway through grade 9, Sherry became very rebellious. She didn't want to communicate with us anymore. She didn't want us involved in her life. She became a partier. She started doing drugs. She was very promiscuous. She asked us for the birth control pill when she was in grade 10. And so we felt like we had lost our lovely little girl, with whom we'd had a wonderful relationship all through those growing up years. But suddenly everything changed. And so the high school years were really difficult times for us.
What Sherry's parents don't know, what they won't learn until years after Sherry's murder, is that their little girl has been struggling, trying to cope with a horrible trauma.
Back in grade 9, Sherry had been date raped. I don't mean that she was dating, but I mean that one of her friends, her close friends, forced her into a sexual encounter with him. And Sherry wrote in her diary about that situation, diaries which we never read up until that point, that she felt demolished. She felt torn down. She felt like she was of no value anymore. She wasn't worthwhile, that her whole life had been destroyed. And she was suffering from a great deal of emotional pain. And so she started partying at that point and started hanging out with other kids who were hurt. And that life of partying and drugs and sex made her vulnerable to be recruited into prostitution. Sherry was believing a lie. She believed that once this rape had taken place, that her life was of no value anymore, that all her hopes and dreams were dashed, that she could not pick up the pieces and go on.
You'll recall Sherry's classmate describing Sherry as sort of fading away. The outgoing, Bible-reading, cheerful girl is slipping deeper and deeper into trauma.
Hi, I'm Christy Lee, the creator of Canadian True Crime. Join me for an immersive deep dive into some of the most thought-provoking true crime cases in Canada. Using facts curated from court documents, inquiry reports, and news archives, I carefully unravel and analyze each case, exposing the pitfalls of the criminal justice system that everyone needs to know about. Find Canadian True Crime wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CanadianTrueCrime.ca.
It's the summer of 1989, a time when Sherry should be getting ready for grade 12. But she attends that fair her schoolmate Terry described earlier, and it is there that she meets a boy just a year older than her. She tells her parents she's in love, and she's leaving home to be with the boy in Edmonton. Sherry's father describes the pivotal moment when his daughter Sherry's life takes that dark turn.
A young man that she thought she loved turned out to be a pimp and turned her out to turn tricks. The last 10 months of Sherry's life were spent on the streets of cities of Western Canada. On the streets of Edmonton, she went from there to Calgary, from Calgary to Winnipeg, to Regina, and from Regina, eventually to Victoria.
During this period, Sherry's parents are trying to remain connected with their daughter. Speaking to a parliamentary committee, they describe Sherry's first experiences being sexually exploited.
Her very first trick gave her a beating, stole her money. This was cause for the first of many beatings she took from her pimp. This is how he controlled her. He would romance her with sweet words, gifts, and sex, and then give her a beating and tell her it was all her fault. Then she would do anything she could to gain back his favor. Many times she told us, "I love him. He needs me. I'll do whatever it takes to keep this relationship going." He decided where and when she worked, how much money she had to make, even who she could talk to. At the beginning, to be sure that Sherry would be dependent on him, he took her from her hometown, Regina, and put her out on the unfamiliar streets of Edmonton, where she knew no one to call for help. He moved her to Calgary, Winnipeg, back home to Regina, and finally to Victoria, BC, each time to isolate her from us, her family.
Sherry's parents do what they can to encourage her to come home. They want Sherry to know she belongs with them. Sherry is arrested a couple of times and returned home to her parents. In a newspaper account from the time, Sherry's father recalls his daughter telling them she won't be doing this forever, that her boyfriend will get a straight job, and that they'll set up a home together. Everything will be rosy. But Sherry's dad believes she knew it was a fantasy. The same report from the Regina Leader Post includes the following details. In the spring of 1990, Sherry and several young hookers from Regina travel with three pimps to Victoria. Sherry later contacts BC Social Services to help get her off the streets. Her parents speak with her one last time on May 17th.
Hello?
Her mom recalls Sherry's boyfriend screaming at her in the background. She asks about her relationship and is told it isn't good. Sherry is unhappy and they are fighting a lot. Sherry tells them she loves them and to keep praying for her. And then early in the summer of 1990, Sherry's phone calls home just stop. Here's what I've been able to learn about the last night Sherry Lynn Smith was seen alive. This information is gleaned from multiple published reports from that time. According to the former roommate, Melody, Sherry hadn't worked for a couple of weeks, but was turning a few tricks to make enough money to return home. On the evening of June 3rd, Sherry and her friend walked the streets and attract a few customers. Police believe her sex trafficker stays back in the hotel room with another man drinking beer and eating pizza. At around 1:30 a.m., Sherry is seen strolling along the corner of Government and Yates. That was the last time anyone, except for her killer, will see Sherry Smith alive. Sherry's friend Melody tells the Vancouver Sun that she was coming back from a date and had left Sherry at the corner. She went around the block with her date, and when she got back, Sherry was gone. Melody says she stayed another hour waiting for Sherry, but she never came back. Now, date is a term those involved in the sex trade use to describe a client. But whomever picked up Sherry that night isn't a date, and they may not even have been a client. They could simply have been posing as a client. Sherry's father will never forget the day he learns his daughter has been killed.
September the 11th, 1990, I still remember the day very clearly. A Regina City police officer came to our door, and Sherry was a missing person. And he came and said, "Mr. Smith, I have news about Sherry." But it was not the news we wanted to hear. He told us that a man riding horseback outside of Victoria had discovered the remains of a female body, and that was the body of our daughter, Sherry.
Sherry was last seen at the beginning of June, but her body isn't discovered until September 9th, 1990. A news article quotes Detective Nelson Patton as saying the exact cause of death has not been determined. I speak to now retired Detective Patton. He remembers Sherry's case well and remembers meeting her parents. It's his understanding that Sherry's case is still being investigated. It's his hope that with time and technology, Sherry's killer could yet be identified. And he worries about harming any ongoing work. So he won't talk to me on the record. The cause of death is not released, but it's confirmed she died violently. Sherry's mom will later tell the parliamentary committee that an autopsy showed her daughter had been beaten to death. I make a request to the BC Coroner's Office for a report on Sherry's death. At this point, I haven't received anything back. Sherry's parents will spend the decades after their daughter's murder trying to help other kids avoid Sherry's fate.
And so we have spent a great deal of time teaching parents to protect their children, to teach their children that they're valuable kids. Even when bad things happen, they still can put their lives back together again. They can still be successful. They can still have happy lives. They're not demolished by these things.
I think as a parent, it's very difficult to force young people to share with you things that have happened to them, even though they're maybe very traumatic. And so really we try and tell parents that you need to, before this bad thing happens, you need to be on a place with your young people where they can feel free to share those kinds of things with you. They need to know that they will not be judged. They need to know that no matter what happens to them, no matter what they've done, you accept them and you love them unconditionally. And when a child knows that, then they'll be much more likely to be open with you about things that are going on in their life.
Hearing Sherry's story is making me aware of just how little I know about sex trafficking. If I'm going to understand what led to Sherry's death and the deaths of Kimberly and Melissa as well, then I need to learn more about what child sexual exploitation looked like in Canada back then.
What people need to understand is this happens to families right across our country in every community. My name is Janet Campbell, and I'm the president and CEO of the Joy Smith Foundation. My mother, Joy Smith, was a parliamentarian who actually passed two private members' bills directed at human trafficking.
Janet Campbell is a leader in the fight against sex trafficking in Canada.
Yeah, so the foundation has three areas of focus. So education is our greatest weapon.
As we begin to speak, I realize just how many misconceptions I have about what sex trafficking looked like then and now.
These victims come from every social background, every economic background. They come from wonderful families. It's just something that is extremely prevalent in our society.
When I began researching this series, I had it in my mind that these young women had somehow made poor choices in life. Inadvertently, I was guilty of some level of victim blaming.
They have their perspective that somebody makes a choice to go down this path and that they end up in a situation like this because of poor choices or something like that. And that's actually not the case at all. They are victims. It is something that they have been preyed upon. And those that do this to others know exactly what they're doing. They're very, very, very skilled. It's not a choice that somebody makes to have this heinous crime perpetrated upon them. It is really a process of recruiting, grooming, manipulating, and controlling another individual.
If I'm going to understand what led to Sherry's death and the deaths of Kimberly and Melissa as well, then I need to learn more about child sexual exploitation and what it looked like back then.
It very much starts off as though the individual thinks they've met somebody that they really connect and click with and that they do have a romantic interest. The individual will treat them like they've never been treated before. They will shower them with affection and understanding and validation, and they will shower them with gifts and experiences that they've never received before. And they really do believe that they're in a relationship and that this individual loves them.
It's clear. Sherry was the victim of a targeted plan.
Then what happens is they will work to create separation with that individual and their support systems. And so sometimes that separation is physical, so they will have them run away from home or leave home. Other times that separation is more emotional. And so that's where it can play out in a scenario that looks more like a rebellion or a phase that the individual is going through. But they create this separation from their support systems. And the victim really believes that this person gets them, they love them, they are going to care for them, they want to do what they can for them.
In the years after Sherry's murder, her parents chose to put themselves out there. The Smiths are pioneers in Canada, speaking out against sex trafficking long before it became a criminal offense in 2005. The Smiths laid the groundwork for those like Janet, who carry the torch today. I can't imagine the strength it would take to turn that grief into something hopeful. Through it all, it's their Christian belief that sustains them.
For us, the core is our faith in Jesus Christ, that no matter what happens to us, God loves us, that the difficult things that happen to us make us better people when we reach out to God, when we ask for His help in these kinds of situations.
Sherry's parents will look to God for solace as 1990 comes to a close without answers about what happened to Sherry. But in the year ahead, another family will have their lives shattered.
She's just adorable. She's the most adorable little thing. She has long blondie, like it's like different shades of blondish hair. And I used to braid it. And I often said that it would look like honey. It looked like when you are pouring honey and you see the different colors as it's dropping into the bowl you're putting it in. And she had a really big, she had big front teeth. So when she smiled, it was like a big cheesy smile, like her whole face lit up because her front teeth were larger. You know what I mean? They weren't protruding, but they were just a big set of teeth. And her whole face would light up. She had like hazily colored eyes. So just everything was kind of sparkly. She was just a joy.
Melissa Nicholson is murdered in the summer of 1991. She will be the third teenage girl killed in Victoria in about 12 months. Now, it's that cluster in time and place that has me wanting to learn more about all three girls and whether there could be a link to their murders. I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Island Crimes Season 6, Sweethearts. If you or someone you know may be a human trafficking victim, call the Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-833-900-1010. The hotline is a confidential, multilingual service. It operates 24/7 to connect victims and survivors with social services, law enforcement, and emergency services. It also receives tips from the public.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.